This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The 2016 U.S. presidential election was a perfect example of how the internet is playing an increasingly large role in our societies. The idea that Russian hackers attempted to interfere in the vote tallies and that fake news from both inside and outside the U.S. swayed voters significantly exemplify the powerful role of the digital world. Internet technology has far outpaced the ability of governments to regulate cyberspace, and that has consequences that can be both good and bad for societies. Exploring this in a new book is my guest Alexander Klimberg, Program Director at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and an associate and former fellow at the Belfar Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. He's advised a number of governments and international organizations on cybersecurity and internet governance. And he now joins me to discuss his new book, The Darkening Web, The War for Cyberspace. Welcome to the program, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
So first, this idea that the government, the U.S. government, was responsible for inventing the internet is, of course, true, but in part, right? How did something that was initially created through government funding very quickly become controlled by and have its architecture, if you will, controlled by technology, by internet programmers, by individuals and corporations?
So saying the internet was invented by government is like saying the microwave oven was invented by government. So a lot of things were invented by universities that were receiving government subsidies, and the same is true as with the internet. So the internet simply received a lot of government subsidies and was built with government money, but it was built by academics in universities and not by actual government departments. So from its very start, even though the money came from the government, the people who were building the internet were hobbyists and academics. So it was never a question if this weird entity that we now call the internet was going to remain a government entity or a commercial entity. In the 1980s, the government internet was split off from the commercial internet. The military made its own internet, as it were. And from that point on, it became very clear that the internet had to remain a non-state domain. And that was primarily the wish of people who were actually building the internet. And that wasn't only these professors and researchers within universities, it was also the hobbyists who were dedicating a lot of time and effort to build this edifice that we call the internet today, as they are doing today as well. So it's important to underline that the people who build the internet very often are doing so unpaid in a volunteered fashion. And therefore, the internet has grown in a bottom-up fashion and not a top-down fashion. And that has only accelerated in the recent decades.
And so, of course, I think then it's only natural then that the resulting situation, the resulting thing that we have today is kind of amorphous. How much of the story that you tell relies on our definition of what the internet is, what cyberspace is, and how those definitions are kind of different depending upon which entity is doing the defining?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So there are different ways of viewing the internet. So if we take, for instance, the classic way that we view the internet today, it's primarily a bottom-up affair. It was created by hobbyists, by academics, and it's basically influenced only by the users. Indeed, one of the most important principles of the internet today is the end-to-end principle, which basically means something called net neutrality, which most people will have heard of before. And effectively, this means that the user determines how the internet looks like, not, for instance, the cable providers or, for instance, government. So this is a bottom-up view of the internet where there are many, many different organizations that play a different role in basically managing internet resources, and there is no center. There are a couple of very important nodes, very important points, but no absolute center. So that's one view. The other view is a top-down level, a top-down view of looking at what the internet could be. And this top-down vision of the internet, that was tried before. It was tried in France. For instance, there was something called Minitel, which only went out of business a couple of years ago, but also in Russia. So the Soviet Union tried to develop an internet around the same time as the US was trying to develop an internet, and it was a very much a top-down affair. And that meant, however, that it couldn't possibly succeed, just like Minitel couldn't succeed in France because of the complexity involved. It also couldn't succeed because of the different dreams involved. The dream of the internet we have today is a bottom-up affair where people are effectively in a trusting environment and cooperate together freely. The top-down internet is above one thing and one thing only, and that's about control. And this is the type of internet that some countries like Russia and China would like to see, an internet that has a centralized component that government can influence and that effectively helps guarantee their own personal security.
And then you have countries like the US and others that have a different approach, that are basically resigned themselves to the internet being a non-state space, right?
I don't know if resigning is the right term. It was an active decision made back already in the Reagan administration, continued over George H.W. Bush, Clinton, and then Bush Jr., and then Obama. It was a decision that was made very early on that the internet needed to be a non-state space, simply because this was too important to be under the control of one government. So other governments among the so-called like-minded nations in the West and liberal democracies sometimes have struggled with the idea of having such a powerful edifice under no central control and not having government as the ultimate arbitrator. But they've accepted it. They've accepted that this is the way it has to be simply because it's too complex to be organized centrally. However, countries like Russia and China have not accepted it. They do want to have a much more stronger government role over this domain, and that is part of the confrontation that we have today.
And Russia and China often referring to the term cyber sovereignty, right?
Correct. We use the term in the West very often to describe their view. They talk about internet sovereignty. Their notion is very simple, is that countries should be ultimately completely 100% responsible for all the information consumed inside by their citizens within their cyberspace. So basically, China and Russia and many other countries, including in the Arab world, but sometimes also in India and Brazil, although those two countries are called swing states in this debate, are mostly concerned with the ability of government to control the information of cyberspace within their domain. This is primarily, therefore, a censorship question. They want to be able to ascertain that no information is consumed by their citizens, which would be detrimental to the rule. On the other hand, it also can be argued that it's a true national security issue, that they want to be able to secure their own government systems better and therefore want to be sure that their cyberspace, under parenthesis, their cyberspace, because it's very hard to draw borders in cyberspace, really is under their effective control. But my view is that the argument of having control over government systems is not the most important argument. Their most important argument is control over their local population. And that is the most important goal for them. And therefore, they are quite willing to seek a number of confrontations with the liberal democracies, because for them, the most important thing is to be able to consume the information consumed by their citizen.
Now, Alex, the issue of cyber security, the issue of cyber war, even this term cyber war, began being explored in the very early days of the internet, right? You point out in your book that in 1995, Time magazine had an article, a cover story called Cyber War, where it quite effectively, with great foresight, saw what would eventually become very real threats. Tell us what Time magazine viewed as cyber war and how they sort of predicted the place we are in today.
Well, one thing is certainly true is that things are pretty much circular in cyberspace. We keep on coming back to the same topics every couple of years because time moves so quickly in cyberspace. We just simply forget the lessons that we learned 4 or 5 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. And in Time's case, what they were doing is they were picking up on a number of developments within the US military in terms of where cyber operations were supposed to develop to. And there were two different views. One view was the more kinetic aspect, and talking about cyber as for instance, as an expansion of military capabilities already existing, such as to take down an integrated air defense system to allow bombers to fly through, like to support a traditional military mission. And the second view was to look at cyber as a psychological warfare tool. And the Time magazine picked up this debate that was occurring within the US military. And that actually drew upon one of the very first cyber operations conducted by the US, which was against Haiti. And it's quite interesting because when you look at a lot of the secondary literature, the operation against Haiti in the early 1990s, so the president of Haiti was considered a dictator and was going to be removed by UN resolution, he was considered a dictator and was facing a U.S. military intervention, and the U.S. effectively launched a cyber campaign to help weaken his rule, but that cyber campaign was a information warfare campaign. And it's quite interesting when you look at the secondary literature today, when they talk about Haiti as being one of the first cyber campaigns, they never really seem to realize that the cyber component of it was pure information warfare. It involved calling up police officers and military officers and basically telling them, listen, back off, we know where you live, you don't want to be part of this. And it didn't involve actually hacking or deactivating critical infrastructure. So Time magazine really captured back then the dilemma that the U.S. government was facing quite deep down within the military of what direction to take cyber operations.
So now we have a situation here in the United States where there is a real fear of our computerized weapon system being hacked from the outside, right? And this is what a lot of countries fear. How real are those fears? How vulnerable are these systems? We worry about Donald Trump's finger on the button, but are weapon systems of nations like the US and Russia vulnerable?
So that's a very broad question. The weapon systems, of course, can range from a weapon system can range from a tank to atomic missiles. And the strategic deterrence is considered actually to be somewhat vulnerable to cyber attack. There were two studies that came out in the last couple of years that indicated that even the U.S. nuclear deterrent wasn't completely invulnerable from cyber attack. But two things need to be said here. First of all, it doesn't mean the missiles can be launched. That's by abroad. I consider that to be very, 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 very unlikely. And second of all, unfortunately, ultimately, pretty much everything is hackable. It's not a question of what can be secured. It's how insecure is something. And it's how much effort does your adversary want to put in to breaking into a system. So this is something that we have to get used to a certain extent, is that there's no such thing as absolute security. There's also no such thing as being disconnected from cyberspace. You can take yourself off the internet, but you can't take yourself off cyberspace. And for the same reason, we can only guarantee a certain level of security for all types of systems, including military systems, but we cannot guarantee them completely.
Let's expand on that term, on that sentence you just said. You can take yourself off the internet, but you can't take yourself out of cyberspace. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, many people might say that, I'm not on the internet, I'm not in cyberspace, I don't use email, I never use online transactions. And that's true. If you're not on the internet that way, you might limit more or less the data being collected by you, but that data is being collected in cyberspace. So that data about you is being held by the government, by the schools of your kids, by your employer. You may have no idea that data is out there, but it is out there. It's being collected by you, by all kinds of things that you do, even if those are not from internet-generated activities. And that means that data will be stored sometimes in not internet-accessible formats. So a lot of people will say, our system is secure because it's not connected to the internet. The internet is smaller than cyberspace. Cyberspace is the entire world behind your screen. And to give you an example of what that means, if I have an internet in my office, for instance, that's not connected to the wider internet, I'm still on cyberspace. Your fridge at home, if it is potentially connectable to the internet, is part of cyberspace. Everything that could potentially be connected through network technology is part of cyberspace. And all data that resides in these types of networks is part of cyberspace. So cyberspace is basically the sum total of all digital activities, both man and machine, and how much those activities really come down to your individual preferences and actions, i.e., I'm going off and purchasing something online, that's nearly a moot point, because a lot of data will be gathered upon you on the way you pay your bills, on how you do at work, everything else that you have no control over. So you can't really escape cyberspace, even though you can limit your presence on the internet.
Now, a lot of Americans One of the first things that occur to most Americans when they think about security in the digital age is their own personal information security. And of course, with the revelations from media based on files given to them by, say, Edward Snowden, we know our government collects data on us. We know that corporations also collect data on everything we do to market. There was a news now that the Trump administration's Department of Justice is attempting to get the information of the more than million Americans who visited or registered with an anti-Trump website during the inauguration. So there's always this temptation by governments, but also corporations, to have control over people's information. Is that part of the darkening of the web that you also talk about in your book?
Well, it potentially could be. And this is part of an evolving discussion that I think we all need to pay more attention to. There are two different, very extreme views here that you've summarized. On the one hand, you have the corporation view, which effectively helps provide us with services that we largely consider to be for free. So Facebook, Google, all these services are provided effectively in exchange for our data. And they wouldn't be able to function otherwise. And we would have to pay for them. And then it would be a question of those who can protect their own data would pay, and those who cannot afford to pay for data protection would not pay and have their data taken. So that wouldn't be a very good situation either. So you have the one view that we are paying for these free services with our data, and that this data is never seen by a human being. It's seen by an algorithm. It's seen by mathematical formula, which have no direct implications on our privacy. This was once expressed by Eric Schmidt of Google, who basically said worrying about an algorithm seeing your data is like worrying about your dog seeing you naked. It just doesn't make any sense, right? So that's that view, and that's the Silicon Valley view. And then there's another view, which is very much born in Europe, and especially in Germany, where they have more immediate experiences of government misuse, and that is that every data that can be collected will be misused. And that the danger is that any data that is collected will potentially be stored forever and therefore at one point will be misused, i.e. by commercial sources or by government. And their approach is very radical, to lock down all types of data sharing and all types of personal data provision. But what they don't answer then is how do services like Google and Facebook and others survive without us paying for them? So we have these two extreme views. Everybody provide all of their data because effectively it's for free and it's not really a violation of our privacy, and don't provide any data because it will be misused. I think that in the very least, while we have this conversation unfolding, we should take a sensible middle approach. And there's different ways you can do that. You can try to, for instance, limit your certain types of your browsing habits, and you also can use certain plugins which will limit to the extent that you can be tracked online. You also can use encrypted software more often, which I think is good out of principle because it also lowers the possibility that other actors like cyber criminals will be able to spy on your systems. Fundamentally, however, I think it's also important that people understand there is no absolute security in cyberspace. None at all. And that goes for the individual as well as for governments. Hmm. And fundamentally, that's part of the new normal that we are living in today.
Wow. Now, when we hear the term cybersecurity, what does that mean? And does it mean different things to different people? You know, we hear of there's cybersecurity conferences happening all the time. The corporate world is interested in cybersecurity. The U.S. government and government actors in general are interested in cybersecurity. There's a discussion around cybersecurity at the international level. But this, you know, is a bit of a vague term, isn't it?
Absolutely. Cybersecurity used to be the term that, in particular, hackers and members of the so-called information security community, the technical community that do incident response online that I am also a member of, they used to really hate that term, cybersecurity, because it didn't mean anything, really, from their point of view. Today, it's become commonly accepted that it means something, in particular because the Snowden revelation showed us that the Uber hackers of the NSA have been using the term cyber for nearly 20 years now. But fundamentally, you are correct that we can't even spell the word cybersecurity, you know, therefore it's practically impossible for us to have a common definition of what it actually means.
You're referring to the fact that some people think of it as two words or versus one word.
Exactly.
There's no agreement on that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, we can't even, and I've even seen the different spellings in the same document by certain governments. But there's really no common understanding what it means. To come back to your original question, because you're absolutely right, there's so many different ways in how we can view the term cybersecurity, both in terms of private sector government or different parts of the practice. But the highest level difference is between liberal democracies and authoritarian states. And in that context, liberal democracies view cybersecurity primarily as being a technical issue, as being an issue that revolves around technical matters that are resolved around professionals, and the worst outcome is a cyber war that potentially means mass destruction of critical infrastructure. So that's like a Western view of cybersecurity at the highest level. A Chinese, Russian, Eastern view of cybersecurity is totally different. From them, it's a psychological issue, and the worst possible outcome is information warfare. Really, the worst possible outcome is the collapse of their regime, is the undermining of their government by internet-organized dissent. And these two very different views, this two different nightmares, one of a cyber war where the lights go out, and the other of effectively of a popular uprising that brings down your regime. Those are probably part of the problems when America, Russia, and China try to have conversations about cybersecurity. They mean two very different things.
Right. And as people who are involved in the Arab Spring know very well, who controls the internet is very much intertwined with what direction an entire country can take in terms of the regime. Alex, I want to go to back to what you were saying earlier in our discussion around Haiti. You mentioned the US government's earliest use of this idea of information warfare, and I started our conversation bringing up the issue of fake news and its role in the US election. We think of fake news, the definition of fake news is vague, certainly, but the news that is sort of has hysterical headlines that deliberately exaggerate stories to sway things like elections, to sway people's ideology. Is that also part of this story, this exploration of cyberspace that we should think about, and in a way, a form of information warfare, even if it's not sort of directed by a government necessarily?
Absolutely. The whole idea of cyberspace is that it is the information domain. It's the sum total of all information out there. That information can be crafted and used as a weapon is, however, also the main notion of countries such as China and Russia. And their idea is to continue this dialogue in a direction that effectively allows us to have a dialogue about censorship, which is why we have to be very wary of comparing information warfare with cyber warfare. Those are two different things that we should try to keep separate, even if they both use cyberspace. The fake news discussion that you talked about previously and how it influenced the US election also gives us, for instance, an indication of how we can best respond to information warfare, not cyber warfare, but information warfare. And that's quite simple. If we agree, and I do agree, that Russia was launching a multidimensional campaign against the United States, something that used to be called active measures or simply multidimensional propaganda and influence operations against the US to try to influence the election. If we agree that fake news was part of it, then we need to, however, ask ourselves why were these measures so effective? And what is quite interesting for me is that Russia also launched similar campaigns against many countries in Europe. Sweden, Finland, Estonia, Germany, and most recently France were all subject to similar campaigns. All of these countries were able to better resist these campaigns than the US. Why was the US so susceptible? That's part of the question, is that the only way we can respond to an information warfare campaign is, in my opinion, is better resilience, is better strength. And I think that it was quite clear that in the case of the US elections and the US and the Russian involvement in the US elections, that the main problem was US weakness, not Russian strength. And that is something that only can be solved with increased resilience on part of the US. Other countries have managed to do that. How you respond to cyber threats and cyber war is a different question for me. Information warfare question, however, needs to be primarily be seen with how can your own society be more resilient to such, for instance, perversions of the news through active propaganda measures of other states.
Right.
And I think that type of dialogue is something that we need to have in the US as well.
You know, in terms of how you explain to ordinary people why they should care about things like cyberspace and cybersecurity, your book certainly is an eye-opener for why we should care. But how do you make the case? I mean, we're worried about having access to healthcare. We're worried about fully funded schools. And now we have to worry about the darkening web. But it is there, and it is becoming bigger and less, you know, and more unwieldy, whether we like it or not, right?
Right. Well, as you say, another thing that's demanding our attention. So essentially, my point is very simple. It's like finance. It's like the financial system. You don't need to know everything about it, but it is relevant to you personally and very directly. So you do want to know if the stock market is going to go up or down, and you do want to know if the mortgage rate on your house is going to go up or down. You might not need to know if the Hang Seng is going to go up or down, or the Dow, or what the interbank lending rate in the UK is, but you do want to know basic fundamentals about the financial system and how it's developing. The same applies to cyberspace and cybersecurity. There is too much at stake. Our own personal security is directly involved in how cyberspace develops. The way we live our lives, the way we educate our children, the way we entertain ourselves, the way we effectively do our politics and live in our public lives is increasingly defined by cyberspace. If we opt out of this, if we basically say, I really don't understand any of it, it's like the plumbing, and I really don't care, then effectively we are handing over the control of this domain to governments. But government did not build cyberspace. And even if it's the US government, and we more or less trust the US government to do the right thing, first of all, governments can change. Second of all, they don't always do the right thing, even if they are generally speaking considered to be trustworthy organizations. And thirdly, there are other governments, not like the US government, who are just generally untrustworthy, and we don't really want to give them influence over the internet. So we need to be aware of what potential interests are focused at the internet as it is today. Because if we are not interested in how the internet develops, then those who have a more keener interest in seeking to control aspects of cyberspace, they will assert themselves. They will take control over what was previously a non-state domain maintained by private individuals and citizenry, and they will make it theirs. And if that happens, we will only lose. There is no winning here for us. The only way to resist it is by basically being aware of the general factors that are developing, and when necessary, speak out. And some of the very small, one of the issues like that was net neutrality, for instance. I consider net neutrality not to be an ideological issue, to be a practical issue. And I think that in the US, we saw millions of people respond when net neutrality was threatened. And indeed, right now, even some of those companies that were protesting against net neutrality at the beginning, such as Comcast and others, have actually started to say, actually, net neutrality is probably not a bad thing, because they realize that it's in their interest as well that we have a functioning non-state internet. So overall, I would say, unfortunately, it's another factor that I think everyone needs to come to grips with a little bit. You don't need to know everything about it, but just like the financial system, it has direct relevance to you. And just like the financial system, you do want to be aware of decisions that are made on your behalf. Because if you don't completely agree with those decisions, you can end up in a world where people have made decisions over your head that go radically against your own interests.
Alex, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending this time with us. Much more to discuss. People can pick up a copy of your book to get the fuller picture. Thanks so much.
Thanks for your time.
My guest is Alexander Klimberg, Program Director at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and an associate and former fellow at the Belfar Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. He's advised a number of governments and international organizations on cybersecurity and internet governance, and we've been discussing his new book, The Darkening Web, The War for Cyberspace. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.